willkommen zu Vom Halm zum Glas, dem offiziellen Schulz-Podcast. Alles rund ums Brauen, Melzen und Destillieren. Mit Gesprächen zu Fachthemen, Erfolgsgeschichten und echten Typen aus der Branche.
Hi everyone and welcome to a new Schulz-Podcast episode Vom Halm zum Glas. My name is Carolina and I work in marketing for Kaspar Schulz since 2013. I already hosted two of our German podcasts and will try my best for this English one, so please bear with me. Today I have the big pleasure to be sitting in Oxford, Connecticut with Ben Neidhardt from OEC Brewing. Ben, great to meet you and to see the brewery.
Nice to meet you too.
Could you please introduce yourself and OEC Brewing to our listeners?
My name is Ben and I own OEC Brewing, and we started in 2014. We started by doing a lot of mixed fermentation and experimental type of beers, but now we also brew a lot of open fermented lagers.
And what does OEC stand for? I read it's something in the Latin language, but I won't even try to pronounce it.
So a lot of people think that, it's very serious what it means, but it's actually kind of a joke. If you ever listen to the old or watch the old Monty Python skits with the old Romans, they did these skits on badly conjugated Latin. And it's really badly conjugated Latin. That means like the eccentric boilers. And we called it boilers because prior to Pasteur being around and figuring out that, bacteria or yeast caused the fermentation of beer, they didn't know what was fermenting the beer even. So there was a lot of mysticism in beer in the old days. So for example, everything was called boiling because they didn't know what fermentation was. And initially when you boil the beer, you heat it up, you get the bubbles rising to the top, the foam going on top. And then later on it cools and it starts doing the same thing again, but cold. And that's the fermentation, but they call that boiling also. So you, as a brewer, you weren't called a brewer, you were called a boiler. And then let's say you had one pot that was fermenting and one that wasn't, they put them next to each other so they could learn how to ferment. And so like, if you look at our insignias and all that stuff, it's kind of a play on like the secret societies and, I liked like knights when I was a kid. And so like, you deal with like seals and that kind of stuff. And I thought it was funny. So that's where it comes from.
Really cool. So your philosophy kind of revolves a lot around fermenting.
Yeah. So our philosophy deals a lot with not just fermentation, but also some of the old methods behind it. A lot of the methods that were discovered for fermentation, they did empirically and just by trial and error. But a lot of that's been almost passed on through modern technology, right? I mean, you could create quite a good beer with virtually very little ability to clean, but that's kind of forgotten because now we have, stainless steel and we have a lot of new technologies. And so we don't have to deal with some of the problems that they dealt with historically. But when you look at their challenges and how they overcame it, they're very interesting processes. And so we deal a lot in those as well.
Can you tell us the background history for OEC Brewing?
The original idea started when we got involved into the packaging of imported beer from BeUnited International. That's my family's company. So we brought it, bringing beer from all over the world. For example, Schlenkerle in Bamberg, we import. And to make sure that the quality of kegs is as high as possible, we decided to change our method of bringing these beers in 2010, 2011. Prior to then, we had a keg pool roughly of, I would say, 10,000 kegs. And they would ship back empty to all over the world. Let's say if the brewery was in Germany or Japan or Belgium or England. But we always ran into all kinds of issues. First of all, it's very difficult to track all those kegs. Second of all, every country actually uses different types of fittings on the kegs. So every once in a while, you ended up a brewery getting kegs and saying, hey, we can't fill these. So we decided it would be better if we could just keep the kegs in the United States. And then we send out different vessels to collect the beer and we do the filling of products here. So we contracted a company in the UK who builds these tank containers for, let's say, the orange juice industry or other, food producers for transport. And we had them do it for beer. And one of the differences we made is that it's a 20-foot container, but it's split into four different compartments. So rather than just one big compartment where you have one type of beer, we're able to bring in four beers. And these tank containers, they have their cooling units on them for temperature control, and all the compartments are pressure controlled as well. So they get lifted up onto the boats. They get driven to the breweries to be filled one by one. It could all be filled by one brewery, or sometimes, for example, even three or four breweries. It goes through Germany. And then it gets lifted right back on the boat. It comes here and then gets driven here. We plug it back in here, and then we take care of the final portion of packaging the beer. By learning to package the beers, we got a good handle on quality control and cleanliness, as well as the final portion of the beer production process. And then from then, we started also doing a collaborative project with some of our breweries in terms of doing some sour beer aging in red wine barrels, white wine barrels, and even a couple spirits barrels or so. So then we learned to experiment with the beer before packaging in different varieties as well. And then we finally came to the conclusion we should also try brewing our own beers.
And you do it really successfully.
We try to.
So on your website, I saw a lot of beer, and they are categorized into four groups. Usual suspects, less usual suspects, even less usual suspects, and retired.
Yeah.
How many beer styles do you brew?
A lot. I don't know. if I go to the website, I could probably count some together, but we do a decent amount. Yeah.
So it's too much to count.
Yeah. We've done a lot. We also do a lot of traditional German styles now. We do some English styles. We obviously do some Belgian styles. Then we do a number of experimental things. So
yeah, the experimental thing is really, really great. It's mind-blowing, to be honest. I don't even know how to start talking about everything you do here. You even have your own greenhouses, orchards, and a vineyard. Can you give us an overview about all the variations of fermenting processes that you do?
So we do a lot of fruited sour beers, but the fruits that we use in these beers, we try and grow ourselves. One of the things is when you purchase them and they come from various places, we wanted them to not have any pesticides or any, chemicals used on them. And the fresher you use them, the more immediately you use them, the more intense the flavors are from them. So we have a couple greenhouses on site, and we grow a lot of our own citrus fruits, like types of smaller oranges. Meyer lemons do very well. We do some limes and some other citrus fruits. We have, for example, yuzus, which are more common to Japan. And then we also do a lot of raspberries that we have. We have strawberries, and we do have some grapevines. This isn't the best area for growing grapes in the sense that there's too much rainfall here. So the fruit isn't concentrated enough to make wine, but it's quite interesting in the production of sour beer.
So we saw a lot of vessels you use for fermenting. Which vessels do you use? And why?
Yeah, we use a wide variety of vessels for fermentation. One of the most common ones, not so common in the US, but you still see it in Germany to some parts, is we use a lot of open fermentation. A lot of breweries refuse to do that now because it's a little bit more challenging. You have to make sure your cleanliness is better, and you have to know what you're doing, because if you let the beer ferment too long, where the yeast is too far along, then the beer is not as protected. So you need to be able then to move the beer at the right time as well. But along with those vessels, we also have some granite fermenters, or they're rather granite maturation vessels. These are made from Bavarian granite, one pink and one blue. They're 600 liters in capacity, but weigh 6,000 pounds.
Wow.
So they're not very big, but they weigh a lot. And they're very unique in what they do. Initially, our feeling when we purchased them was that they'd add a good amount of minerality. But what they actually do is they add quite a bit of fruitiness, almost like a hybrid of maybe raspberry or like a fresh peppercorn. And then we obviously have a lot of red wine barrels that we get. We've sourced them from all over the world, including, you know, the famous regions of the U.S., which is like Napa, California, but we get some from Oregon as well. We source them from South Africa also. And then we have a few white wine barrels mixed in from the vineyards as well. Not quite as many because they're harder to get. We have some interesting spirits barrels, including absinthe, which are very aromatic and botanical. Really neat. A few gin barrels. For a long time, we were getting really interesting gin barrels from this vineyard in Oregon, and they did three agings of their red wine, which was like a Pinot Noir base, and then one aging of their gin. So they were almost what we consider hybrid barrels. Really interesting because they had the fruitiness of the wine, but they also had the botanical aspects from the gin. So really cool barrels. And then we have some amphoras, which are a little bit more on the difficult side to work with as they're quite porous. So whatever you age in there, it has to be able to handle a little bit of oxygen uptake.
That's really interesting. It's mind-blowing how you do all of this because it's a lot of work.
Yes, it is a lot of work. And it's a lot of, you know, it's also a lot of experimentation because you don't know. You know, if you put your beer in a stainless steel tank, it's very neutral and you kind of have a pretty good idea of what's about to happen. If you put it into a granite vessel, you're not so certain.
Yeah, I imagine it's really difficult just to achieve reproducible results. And I don't know, how do you handle this?
Actually, it's very different because our goal on the clean beers and let's say like the open fermented lagers is to be very consistent from batch to batch, right? But I think the goal is when you're making our experimental product side is not to even worry about consistency from batch to batch. Sometimes it might even be a totally different beer. But the other thing is the uniqueness between batch to batch actually creates a lot of interest for people. So, for example, one of our famous ones we do is called Tempest, and we call it a blended sour saison. It basically is a play on the historic saison production process where they used to blend a little bit of lambic into the saison, making it more sour. And so we give blend numbers to the beers. And then every blend we say, hey, it's going to be slightly different. Like this one might be a little bit more fruity. And a little bit more red wine character versus this one has a touch more sourness, a little bit more wild yeast character. By giving blend numbers to the beers that we make on our experimental series, it makes it very different for the consumer that comes to our brewery because they look forward to tasting the various iterations and they expect something different. To be honest, it would be almost boring if those beers were the same from batch to batch.
So every time your customer arrives, they have to explore something new. That's a good thing. Sour beer is not that common, I think. How did you get to brew it?
You're right. Sour beer is really not that common. And it's usually funny when I meet a German brewmaster because one of the common things they say is that the biggest flaw in beer is sourness. And the way to produce a sour beer is you just don't clean, right? So that's kind of the joke. But one of the things that interested me in sour beer is the actual production process because it's really unique when you look at it. I mean, when you're making a clean beer, you're looking to be more in control of the process by each step of the way, right? I mean, the term for the brewer who masters that is called a brewmaster. But when you're making a sour beer, you give up a lot of the control. And you give that control back to nature. And nature has a natural process where the bacteria and the yeast, they work together to actually preserve the beer. It's really interesting what happens. And of course, you have to give up a lot of control. So it's more like trying to be a coach rather than being in control of the process. And besides liking sour beer and the acidity and the refreshing character of it, I also found the process to be really unique. Now, one of the things you have to do at the end is, let's say you brew a base beer and let's say it goes into about six different wine barrels or so, is then to assemble the final product. because you taste through the barrels and then you have to come up with a blend. You can even take different beers that you blend together. I mean, the possibilities are endless, and it actually allows for a lot of creativity and input for the blender at the end. Quite often, the brewer who brews the batch isn't as enamored in it because he feels a lot more out of control versus the blender at the end regains the control of the production process. And I find that very interesting.
But to me, it seems that you have to have a lot of knowledge to handle that. I get the joke. It's funny, but I think it's the other way around.
Yeah, I guess you need both knowledge, but I guess also you could say you need a little bit of faith that nature is going to help you a little bit along the way, right? And it's not just going to sabotage you. Yep.
So by what you said, a big part of your philosophy is to let nature take over and do its thing and to give up a lot of control to benefit your beer.
Yeah. And it's not just about subduing nature and controlling it, right? It's actually looking to understand the processes and how they work and to give it the ability to do the things that it can, to develop a lot of flavors working alongside nature, not to just subdue it in a sense where you control everything, right? If I look to subdue it and I control the process by going down to one yeast, by not allowing any natural yeast, not allowing it to interact with the materials that it's stored in, let's say wooden barrels or so, I really constrain my outcome set. But if I open that up, it opens up a window of a myriad of possibilities. Now, I know some of those possibilities are bad, but in general, if you understand the base criteria of the fact that you have a natural protection in terms of alcohol and in terms of lower pH, that range of bad outcomes is a lot smaller than you think. And by you embracing those risks, you can have really nice rewards. It's, I think, also nice in today's age because I think we try and fight nature a lot at this point in our lives versus where we've almost given up trying to understand some of its benefits and like the miracles it can create.
I also saw that you produce Eisbock. You have a barn dedicated to it.
Yes. So we try and produce some natural Eisbock, and we did it again this winter. It's very much dependent on how cold our winter is, though. We don't use any artificial cooling, so you really need it to be really cold for about 10 to 14 days straight. And I mean, in terms of like Fahrenheit, you're talking, it needs to get down to at least lows of like 14 or lower, and to be roughly that overnight for 10 to 14 days. And then we'll get a freezing of about, I would say, 15% to 20%. And that's how we make our natural ice box.
So you have to be lucky to get one here.
Exactly. So we got some again last winter, but the previous two winters before then, it didn't work because whenever we had a cold stretch, then it warmed back up again too fast and we couldn't get the amount of freezing we wanted.
What's also really interesting is the Solera setup. Can you explain what it is and how it works?
Solera is a method that's used in port production or fortified wine production. It's basically where you start with a barrel and you fill it up with the original liquid. And then each time you take a small portion out of that and you usually move it from barrel to barrel. So it's a system that kind of builds upon age. So if you start with one barrel and then you take a portion out, you take, let's say, 25% out, then you refill it from a portion from another barrel and you slowly build out the system to be more and more barrels. We do a very kind of small Solera setup for doing some aged barley wines. And these barley wines, they end up quite strong in alcohol, about 14 to 16%. And so it's in a form of whiskey barrels where we keep the initial portion and then we always take a small portion off and then blend that with younger barley wines. And then of that blend that we have, we refill a portion of the Solera barrel.
So can you tell how long it takes to get one batch completely through the system?
So the original Solera barrel now is probably about 4.5, 5 years old. So the initial base liquid in there is 5 years old, but then we've pulled off it about three times now and refilled it. So that barrel keeps aging, and then we blend it with other portions. So to really get the first batch going, it was roughly 3 years.
And what's Uvaga Pit? Oh,
this was one of my dad's ideas. And I guess it's common to, in African cultures, they make some fermented beverages where they store it actually underground or in pits. You know, I think a lot of what people do and what they've done historically is due to the climate they're around. In Africa, it can get very hot and the fermentation can get very out of control, right? So if you bury the vessel in the ground, it's basically like temperature control to get a much more even fermentation. And that was the idea behind the Urwaga pit. So we have a small pit. It's roughly 6 feet by 12 feet, fits about two standard size wine barrels. And we have a little bit of a small crane above it that can crane down the barrels.
And how long is it in there?
We usually put it in the fall and then bring it out in the spring. So it's roughly 6 to 8 months.
And what is the taste? Is it really different from the other sour beer or other beers?
Yes, it's different. The other thing that we do is we cover the methods they use historically. They would use kind of aromatic branches to cover. And so do we. So we use like spruce and kind of cedar branches that are quite aromatic. And somehow, even though the barrel is closed, you do get a little bit of that in the liquid, those aromatics. And the other thing it gets is it gets a little bit of like a kind of that cellar character, a little bit of earthiness. It's very unique.
It's so cool. I remember very well that not long after I first started working for Kaspar Schulz, there was a report in our local newspaper about the test brew you did in Cheslitz. It's a small town near Bamberg.
Yeah.
Where you basically saw the equipment in operation.
Yeah.
So why did it have to be a cool ship and a high polished brew house from Schulz?
So let me answer the brew house question first. One of the things we wanted on the brew house, which was very important to us, was that it was a direct fired system with a copper bottom. And the reason we wanted that is because the heat transmission properties of copper are way, way better than stainless steel. So you can get a much higher temperature out of the burner transmitting to the wort. And that allows for better caramelization and better body in the beer. Now, there are very few companies that can still weld copper to stainless steel. And Schulz is one of those companies that can do so. The other reason for a cool ship was not just because it has a role in making sour beer as well in its history in Lambic, but also because it has a long history in Germany. One of the things that it does is by spreading out the liquid in a very shallow way after the boil is that it blows off a lot of the aromatic properties that you do not want in beer, such as DMS. And so we were recommended by a number of or the breweries that we work with on the import side, smaller traditional breweries, something like Uriga, Didola in Essen, Belgium. They suggested we do a cool ship and we decided, okay, let's try that.
So are all of your beers are going through the cool chip?
Yes. Yeah, so it's interesting because we have this kind of modern Kaspar Schulz brew house and everybody who walks past it looks up and they see all the computers in the center and they're like, oh, that's like a DJ booth, right? So it looks very advanced and we have the computers there. But then we don't have a whirlpool, unlike most modern systems. So we have to settle out and every single beer that we do, whether it is clean or sour, goes to the cool ship for settling.
Of course, you cannot leave the beer for hours and hours on the cool ship because, of course, it would get contaminated. So I saw you have a handy device for cooling the beer even more. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, it's a very outdated device that we use by modern day standards. It's an open counterflow cooler. They call it a Boutelet cooler. And the way it works is that the beer goes on top of it. And it cascades down the outside of these copper pipes. And actually, you push cold water into the bottom and you collect the hot water back out of the top for the next brew day. So it does two things at once. It cools the wort down, but also as the wort cascades down and drops into the trough below, it aerates the beer as well. So you get really good aeration for a nice, strong fermentation. Now, in most modern brew systems, they would have what was considered a closed counterflow cooler or wort chiller, but then they would have to inject air into the wort because as it's a closed system, you get no oxygen take up. So we achieve both of those in the same process. And it was interesting because when we asked Kaspar Schultz to build one for us, they found the designs and they hadn't built one in over 100 years. That's how old it was. And it's an interesting device and it's amazing because when you clean it and you run the cleaner over it, it looks like it couldn't work in a million years. I mean, it sprays everywhere. It shoots everywhere. You're like, this is never going to work. But then when you put the wort on it, the viscosity of the wort is higher and it forms these really beautiful rings as it cascades down the cooler. And it's pretty amazing to see it in action.
Yes, I saw it yesterday. It looks like a beautiful beer waterfall.
Exactly. It's almost hypnotizing yes. The way the rings come down. Yeah.
So you already talked about the reason you went with the Schultz system. How does it support you in brewing your beer on the technical side?
Yeah, I gave one of the reasons, which was the welding of copper to stainless steel. But there was more to it because we also wanted to do complex mashing procedures. I mean, in the US, if you usually get a standard brewing system, they're all based on the British style brewing systems, right? With a mash tun and then a kettle. But we wanted to be able to move the wort a lot. For example, do decoctions or to do what in Belgium they call turbid mashes for lambic style beers. And in each of those processes, you have to move the wort back from the lauter tun back into the boil kettle and then bring it back. So we needed that ability. And then Kaspar Schultz was also able to build it in so we could do a turbid mash where we can pull off the top portion rather than the bottom portion. The traditional German decoction is pulled off the bottom. The turbid mash is pulled off the top. It's especially important for producing good sour beers because to produce a good sour beer, you almost want to achieve the opposite of what you want to do for a clean beer. You don't want a very efficient mash conversion for a good sour beer because for what's important for the sour beer is that you leave some complex chain sugars that the wild yeast and the wild bacteria can eat on over time to create additional flavors and aromas.
Do you have a lot of guests who drink sour beer mainly, or how do they react when they drink it for the first time, or are there mainly beer geeks coming here?
No, I think we have a good mix. So we draw from a local crowd that we have as well, and then we get people who also drive decent distances. You know, we have a lot of customers that live in New York City, and if they go up to, let's say, Cape Cod for vacation, they'll stop by here. A lot of people that work down in New York City also have family that lives up here, so they come and visit us when they go visit their family. We got a lot of people from Boston as well. So we attract both. In terms of what people are drinking, I would say the local crowd drinks a little bit more of the traditional beers in terms of what we do on the lager side and the British side, but we also we have a large contingent that drinks sour beer as well. And a lot of the people that drive long distances to come here are especially into sour beer. They're not so easy to find. And we're one of the producers that more or less specializes in it. Like a lot of breweries will try and make one maybe a year or something like that, but we continuously have a selection of it. The funny thing about sour beer is, and I think this is similar to smoke beers. You guys live in Bamberg. People either love it or hate it.
Yes. Yeah.
There's usually not an in-between, right? Nobody says to you, I kind of like sour beer or I kind of like sour beer. No, that's not what they do.
But do you have a lot of customers who never drank sour beer and then they are really surprised?
Yes, it happens quite a bit. You know, and a lot of those people who end up quite liking sour beer are people who aren't actually really beer drinkers. So we get a lot of people who come with, let's say, friends and they're, let's say, a wine drinker. They end up liking the sour beer because they don't really like normal beer so much. So we get a lot of that crossover.
And where do people get your beer when they want to try it? Is it just here in the tap room or?
No, you can buy it here in the tap room. We do draft and we do package out in the local area as well. But we also go through the Be United distribution network. So you can find a lot of our beer in New York City. You can find it, I think, in about 17 states or so at the moment. Yeah.
You already talked about the greenhouse. So you do a lot of stuff by yourself. You also produce coffee, bread and honey, and basically right away found a fan of your honey. Can you tell us about the story?
Well, we used to try and produce honey. We no longer try and produce honey. One of our staff members, he was really interested in maybe trying to keep some bees, and this was about 4 years ago. He said, okay, we have this nice kind of area. We have combined about 7 acres. Let's try and keep some bees here. They should work well to also pollinate our fruit trees and work with the greenhouses. And so we set up a couple hives. And a couple months later, we saw that one of the hives was beat up pretty badly. It was lying all over the ground. And we were thinking to each other, what, did someone just come here and just check out what's going on? And did they throw over the hive? Maybe a couple kids were drunk. And then we decided to set up a camera. And then we came back after a weekend and we saw the same thing again. So we checked the camera and lo and behold, there was a giant black bear that came and just took the hive apart.
Rude.
He didn't seem to be very much deterred by the bees either. He was very much in it for the honey.
So the bear kind of stopped the process of trying to produce honey?
It wasn't just the bear. It was also that the bees are very sensitive. And I think we didn't realize at the time when we started that we should really have them in a field area where they're more secluded. So like they do travel quite a distance. They travel miles from their hive to go. So they eventually got a little bit aggressive too. They didn't like when a lawnmower came. Then if they're too many guests came to the tap room, then we'd have more bee activity. So we decided that was probably not the best idea and moved on from that project.
But it's great what you try. Your projects, they are really, really impressive. Huh. So yesterday we witnessed the roasting of your coffee beans. I think it's so cool what you do here. And I wonder, you can tell that your curiosity is like endless. It is enough for now, or do you already have new ideas for the future?
We're working on a couple new projects, actually, also kind of unique in the fermentation realm. I mean, as you alluded to, the coffee is one of my dad's projects. He does a partial fermentation of that coffee. So he takes some of the fruits from our orchard and usually one of our liquids, it could be a sour beer or even from the import side, sometimes he does sake or other things. And then he takes from the old exhausted barrels that we use, he takes those staves and he cuts them up and he soaks them in the liquid. And then those coffee beans undergo a short fermentation with the fruits and those staves for about 2 weeks to do a partial fermentation prior to roasting it. Now we're working on a project where we blend in some of our sour beers actually into distilled products, including something like bitters. We're working on developing our own bitters off of the things we're growing and then using either a whiskey or a gin base to blend in the sour beer to almost make something like, it would be like a sour beer cocktail. We'll probably end up somewhere between 10 and 12% in alcohol. So that's a new line we're working on, but we're just kind of working on stability and whether it's actually feasible.
I'm really curious how that turns out. I know I repeat myself, but I'm really just blown away what you guys do here. So everyone who is nearby should definitely stop at OEC, try some beer and attend a brewery tour. It's astonishing what you guys do here. Ben, thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely, it was my pleasure.
For more exciting content about our great customers and innovative products, check our blog Schulz Inside, subscribe to our channel and follow us on social media. You'll find a lot of valuable information about brewing, malting and distilling. Thanks for tuning in and take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Alles rund ums Brauen, Melzen und Destillieren. Das war Vom Halm zum Glas, der exklusive Schulz-Podcast. Genusstechnik seit 1677. Made in Bamberg. Weitere Informationen finden Sie auf kasper-schulz.de. Dieser Podcast wurde produziert von Access Visuals, Film- und Videoproduktion aus Bamberg. access-visuals.de